Democrats strike a deal with U.S. Senator Kyrsten Sinema on their climate and healthcare package. Plus, China agrees to restructure Zambia's debt. Are other poor borrowers next in line? And luxury brands set their sights on middle America.
Gucci going into Columbus, Ohio. Chanel has a boutique opening in Troy, Michigan. Places you wouldn't traditionally think of as luxury markets, but have become luxury markets as we've seen these new pools of wealth emerging.
It's Friday, August 5th. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. And here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. Japan has called on China to immediately end military exercises around Taiwan after Japan's defense ministry said five Chinese missiles had landed in its exclusive economic zone. Beijing is in the middle of 4 days of military exercises, sparked by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's recent visit to Taiwan, which Beijing claims as its own territory. Speaking today in Japan, Pelosi said the U.S. would continue engaging with Taiwan despite criticism from China.
They may try to keep Taiwan from visiting or participating in other places, but they will not isolate Taiwan by preventing us to travel there.
Turning to the U.S., centrist Democratic Senator Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona has won changes to Democrats' climate and health care package, potentially clearing a way to its passage. Under changes negotiated with Sinema, Democrats will pare back elements of a 15% minimum tax on large profitable corporations and drop a proposed tax increase on carried interest income. That is according to people familiar with the agreement, who said Democrats will also add a 1% tax on stock buybacks to the legislation in an effort to reduce the deficit. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said he believed the changes would keep the bill on track in the 50-50 Senate in the face of united Republican opposition. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has said Moscow is ready to discuss a prisoner swap with Washington. People familiar with the matter say U.S. women's basketball star Brittany Griner, as well as former Marine Paul Whelan, could be traded for a Russian arms dealer imprisoned in the U.S. Lavrov's comments, made at a news conference in Cambodia, come a day after a Russian court sentenced Griner to 9 years in prison on a drug charge. Elon Musk has accused Twitter of fraud, saying the company misrepresented the condition of its business and key metrics about its users before he agreed in April to acquire it. That is according to a countersuit filed in a Delaware court that was unsealed on Thursday. In the suit, Musk said he decided to terminate the $44 billion merger agreement after learning of what he described as troubling facts, including a restatement of Twitter's monetizable daily average users days after the pact was signed, and that Twitter was allegedly miscounting the number of false and spam accounts on the platform. Twitter board chairman Brett Taylor said in a tweet Thursday that Musk's claims, quote, are factually inaccurate, legally insufficient, and commercially irrelevant. A lawsuit brought by Twitter against Musk over their stalled merger is set to go to trial in Delaware on October 17th. And the chief executive of Warner Brothers Discovery says the company is exploring launching a free, ad-supported streaming service. It is the latest effort by a streaming giant to boost their user base as competition for users intensifies. The new company, the result of a merger with AT&T earlier in the year, reported its first quarterly earnings as a combined entity, swinging to a loss due to merger-related charges. There is a hot new trend for luxury brands such as Gucci and Chanel, and it involves middle America. Many of the world's glitziest retailers are pivoting their focus to a number of new markets in the U.S. where they've never previously operated standalone stores. And the reason for that pivot has as much to do with China as it does the U.S. Journal business reporter Trevor Moss is here to explain what's going on. Hey, Trevor.
Hello.
So what has changed for these luxury brands that's causing them to set their sights on, of all places, on middle America?
The priority for these luxury brands for a decade or even longer has been expanding in China. That's been their big focus for a long time. What we've seen this year because of the pandemic and some very strict lockdowns in China is that luxury brands have actually performed quite poorly there this year, whereas sales have been very strong in other regions and especially in the US. We've seen some new patterns in wealth in America, cities like Austin, Texas, for example. That's become a really big technology hub where companies like Tesla and Oracle have big operations there. So the pool of luxury consumers in cities like that has really grown significantly, and that's encouraging these companies to invest in stores because they know that the kind of customer they're looking for is now there in large numbers.
Okay, so given that opportunity that these luxury brands see in these new US markets, how are they trying to capitalize on that?
We're seeing the luxury brands already experimenting a lot with pop-up stores in some of the new cities they haven't worked in before, and many are committing to investing in permanent standalone stores in these places, like Gucci going into Columbus, Ohio. That would not have been seen before. Chanel has a boutique opening in Troy, Michigan. Places like this that you wouldn't traditionally think of as luxury markets, but have become luxury markets now as we've seen these new pools of wealth emerging. One thing the brands are saying is that expanding in the US is more tricky than in some other places. The cost of construction is particularly high, and that makes it more expensive to expand in America than it would in Asia and even in Europe in some cases. So the brands are saying that that will make them expand a bit more cautiously, and it might slow them down and limit what they can do there. But they're saying that the investment is worth it, even though it costs more, because the growth is just so remarkable right now.
That was Wall Street Journal business reporter Trevor Moss. Trevor, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, China has announced plans to restructure Zambia's debt. So could that mean Beijing is open to aiding other countries also running into payment trouble? We'll have that story after the break.
ADP knows anything you hear, anything you don't hear, anything you kinda heard, anything you weren't supposed to hear and now have to pretend like you didn't, can change the world of work. From HR to payroll, ADP designs forward-thinking solutions to take on the next anything.
China and other government creditors recently agreed to negotiate debt relief for the southern African nation of Zambia. The move marks a milestone in an international effort to avoid a wave of chaotic defaults among developing countries as interest rates rise worldwide. Journal Deputy Bureau Chief for Africa, Gabrielle Steinhauser, has been following this story from Johannesburg, and she joins us now with the very latest. Hi, Gabrielle.
Hi.
Thanks for being with us. So there are a lot of elements to this story. Could you start by just telling us about the debt that Zambia found itself in?
Sure. So Zambia, over the past decade, has borrowed quite heavily to finance sort of a raft of infrastructure projects, from roads to power plants to airports. And a lot of that money came both from China and from private creditors, including big international banks and three Eurobonds, so dollar-denominated bonds that they sold to international investors. So Zambia is Africa's second biggest copper producer. But for a few years, copper prices were quite low and their economy struggled. Their currency depreciated, which was then again exacerbated by the pandemic. So they actually defaulted at the end of 2020, the first African country to do so during the pandemic.
Would you say that the situation Zambia finds itself in is shared by other countries in Africa that you've been following closely?
We're definitely watching the situation very closely. You do have a lot of countries in Africa and sort of the broader developing world that really started piling up debt, both from China and from private creditors in the years leading up to the pandemic. And while with the pandemic, there was a little bit of relief through an initiative to freeze some of these payments to bilateral creditors, the hit to local economies and just sort of the cost of continuing during the pandemic also saw debt loads really increase over the last 2 years. And a lot of that is now catching up with governments, especially as the Fed is raising interest rates, which is taking money flows out of the developing world. And they're also facing these really high costs for food and fuel, which a lot of them are trying to subsidize for their citizens. So a lot of them are kind of caught between a rock and a hard place, struggling to borrow more money, struggling to pay back the money that they already borrowed, and struggling to help their citizens through an incredibly tough time.
So let's turn now to what China and other creditors have actually offered here. Could you break that down for us?
Right. So a lot of people have been watching Zambia very, very closely because Zambia is actually the first big test case for this new framework that the group of 20 major economies agreed on in November 2020, actually hours before Zambia defaulted, to kind of solve this growing problem in developing countries where the nature of their debt has really changed over the last decade and a half or so. Compared to previous debt crisis, when a lot of the debt that developing countries owed was coming from rich countries like in Europe or the US, now the biggest government-to-government lender to the developing world is China. And the US has accused China of being very slow and reluctant to offer debt relief to countries that are now struggling to pay. China says that they do work with countries individually to offer debt relief, but there have been complaints that these arrangements sometimes are really intransparent. What happened over the weekend was that after a long, long delay, Zambia's bilateral creditors agreed that they would negotiate a debt restructuring for Zambia. So when you look at the language in the statement that was issued, they didn't say very much. They said that they had agreed to renegotiate Zambia's debt. But it's actually an admission that A, the debt had become unsustainable, and B, that they agree with the IMF's assessment of the kind of debt cuts that are necessary to make Zambia's debt sustainable. So we don't know by how much they're cutting the debt, but what we do know is that it will have to be quite a significant cut because that's what the IMF and the World Bank have also said.
Is it too early to say whether other indebted countries around the world, particularly those indebted to China, can breathe a sigh of relief knowing that they too could be in line to get a deal like this from China, a recognition that their debt also is unsustainable in some form?
Yes, I think it's too early to really say like, ooh, now we found the solution. It took a really long time for Zambia to even get to the point where it is now. And we don't actually know the level of debt relief that China and the other official creditors will be offering. I think we also have to understand that this comes at a cost, right? So A, it took a long time for Zambia to get here. That's time and money that they lost in investing in their economy that's going already through a really difficult time. And they're still going to have to negotiate with their private creditors on a debt restructuring as well. So it's not like this is sort of, oh, great, like this this process has worked carefully. I think a lot of countries are still watching very closely on how this will continue to play out.
That was Wall Street Journal Deputy Bureau Chief for Africa, Gabrielle Steinhauser, joining us from Johannesburg. Gabrielle, thanks for bringing us this story.
Thank you.
And finally, as families gather together this summer, kids and their parents might be surprised to find out how tech-obsessed the grandparents have become. A recent AARP report found that after older adults turned to tech to stay connected and maintain normalcy during the pandemic, those tech habits are now enduring. However, WSJ family and tech columnist Julie Jargon says that while parents have good reason to worry about their kids' tech use, those same concerns may not apply to older users.
There's clearly been a lot of evidence that suggests that social media in particular can be harmful to teens. You know, all the comparisons and some of the content around eating disorders can be really harmful. So for older adults, those kinds of concerns aren't there. And in fact, there are a lot of studies that suggest that certain types of usage can be beneficial, like certain digital games can sharpen their cognition and boost memory, and that using smartphones in general can help them combat loneliness, which is a huge issue among older people, by helping them stay connected and entertained.
And that's What's News for Friday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening.